as dowry. The children learned early to avoid their father, for his one hand was quick at backhanded slaps, and his temper was hair-trigger. A crying or teasing or noisy child set him mad with irritation. He was fond of telling what a damned pest kids were, his especially, the damnedest pack of mongrels ever whelped. But if they were mongrels, they had the mongrel's knack of making his own way. Any one of them above the age of 6 could have lived on what he could catch or steal. They grew like savages, black-haired, husky, broad-faced children, with their mother's German features and their father's long bones. Most of their time in summer they spent roaming the wilderness of brushy woods along the Rock River, fishing, robbing garden patches, shooting rabbits and grouse with slingshots or whatever weapon they could lay hands on. By the time the youngest boy, Harry, was 8 years old, they all had guns. One by one, mysteriously, the firearms came. Fred Mason swore they had been stolen and stamped around the house whenever a new gun appeared, but he could never beat a confession out of any of the boys. Elmer had worked for a farmer and made the money for his. George had found his lying right out in the open on a bridge rail and had waited all day to see if anyone would come and claim it, but nobody did. Harry had been given his by a woodchopper up along the river, and so on. Probably the boys felt that guns were a necessity in order to provide food. The chances were 2 to 1 that any time they came home for a meal they would be cornered and whipped for something, if not by their father, then by their mother, who sometimes flew into insane rages and drove even her hair-trigger husband from the house. So the boys stayed away, at least in summer, and lived on the fish and rabbits and corn and vegetables and watermelons of their expeditions. Sometimes they stayed out in the woods for days at a time. In winter there was nothing much to do except go to school. It was a way of avoiding the domestic uproar, and it was a fairly painless way of satisfying parental demands.
"My kid's gonna have an education," Fred Mason was fond of saying. "They're gonna learn to read and write and figure if I have to beat it into them with a wagon tongue."
But one by one the boys dropped out, found jobs, wandered away. None of them except Harry remained in school beyond the 5th grade. Harry stayed till the 8th, partly because he was less indocile than his brothers, partly because he was brighter. He was an intractable enough pupil, and the cause of much academic grief, but his intelligence and his sense of self-preservation were sharp enough to tell him when to stop, and once in a while he got a chance to outface his teacher with some monumental feat of brains. His teacher quit picking on him and gave him his unruly head when Harry was in the 6th grade. From that day on she looked upon him with something like awe, tinctured with mild horror. They were reading McGuffey's Second Reader. For 3 or 4 weeks Harry slaved like a malicious little demon, reading every selection, prose and poetry, over and over until he knew almost the whole book by heart. The class, meanwhile, had spelled its way through 60 or 70 pages. Harry had ceased utterly to pay attention in reading class, loafed ostentatiously at his bench, whittled his initials, honked weirdly when the teacher's back was turned, and then played he had been blowing his nose, pulled the girls' braids, pinked his fellows with a pea-shooter, and raised so much uproar that he was hauled up into the corner and a dunce cap set on his head. From there he grinned and made faces and commented audibly on the reading performances of the others. The teacher was in a tooth-gnashing fury. She had tried whipping before. He was too tough to hurt. Sending him home would just be giving him a chance to go out in the woods and have some fun. So now, smelling a way of humiliating him, the only way he could be heard, she slapped her ruler down on the desk and walked over to him with a wicked and wintry smile.
"Of course, Harry," she said, "you're too brilliant to need any training in reading. But suppose, just suppose now, you take your book and read to us for the rest of the afternoon, pronouncing every word. We'll let geography go just for the pleasure of listening to you. Go on down to your desk and get your reader."
The class snickered. Harry grinned, shaking his head. "I don't need any book," he said.
"I suppose you know it all by heart.
I've read it over. When you're smart, that's all it takes.
All right, she squealed, so outraged at his impudence that her voice cracked. You can start right at the beginning.
With her back stiff and her face tomato red, she marched back to her desk and sat down, her book open before her, ready to pounce on his slightest mistake. At 4 o'clock, she reluctantly turned him and the rest of the class loose. He had reached page 92 with only a few minor errors. Harry Mason had good reason to hate his father, and he took advantage of his reasons. By the time the boy was 14, he was big for his age and hard as flint from an active life of hunting and sports. Yet the beatings that had soured his childhood went on as if he were still a child. All the boys except Elmer had left, George to Chicago, Oscar and Bill to nearby farms, Dave to drive a dray in Davenport. As a result, whenever a neighbor missed a chicken or complained of kids in his melon patch or had his buggy wheels taken off and hung on the ridge of his barn on Halloween or found some youth toying with his daughter in the haymow, Harry had to look sharp if he wanted to avoid a tanning for it. Sometimes he was guilty, sometimes not. Sometimes he got beaten for Elmer's misdeeds because Elmer was too big at 16 to be handled. The procedure was monotonously reiterative. Fred Mason would lay for his one punishable son whenever he heard of a prank or theft. If he caught him, as he seldom did, and the infrequency of his success only whetted his wrath, he would take him out on the porch in full view of the offended public and administer punishment there. Because of his missing arm, he couldn't both hold and whip the boy, so he held him by the collar and kicked his backside with brutal shoes, or hammered his head against a porch pillar. The more he kicked and hammered, the madder he got, and the more stubborn the boy's grim silence became. He never cried for pain, but sometimes after a thumping he would go off in the woods and throw himself on the ground and weep with rage and hatred. Once or twice he ran away to be gone for 2 or 3 weeks, but he always came back, until one day in the summer of his 14th year. In that July, Fred Mason had had one of his occasional spells of ambition, had got together a couple of scythes, and had contracted to cut off the hay in the river meadow west of town. Elmer and Harry were impressed as free labor. They went unwillingly enough, but before they had been working half an hour, they got into a race to see who could mow the greatest swath by noon. They shucked their shirts and shaved mightily in the early heat while their father sat with his back against a tree, smoking his corn cob. Heads down, elbows bent, arms and shoulders swinging, the boys went down the field of damp grass close together, mowing almost in unison. At the fence along the road they turned and started back, still together. Then Elmer, 2 years older and a little bigger, began to inch ahead, and Harry strained to catch him, reaching for the exact cutting power of the scythe. Harry never knew quite how it happened. His head was down, his eyes on the next semicircle of long, wild grass that the scythe would reach. Either Elmer moved a little closer, or Harry, in his hurry, reached out too far, but in the warm, hay-smelling quiet, Elmer suddenly yelped, just as Harry, having felt the sudden, solid obstruction to the blade, stood up. Elmer sat down and rolled up his pants leg. Jets of blood pumped from a long, deep gash in his inner calf. "Oh, my gosh!" Harry said. He dropped on hands and knees and tried to stop the bleeding with his hands, but it burst out of the red lips of the wound and flooded his wrists. Their father came running, swearing at every step. For once Harry saw him move quickly and efficiently. "Give me your shirt," he said. Harry raced for it, came back on the dead run. His father had already laid Elmer on his back, found the artery above the cut, and was pressing deep with his thumb into the brown flesh. The bleeding lessened, came in feeble, choked spurts. Mason jerked his head at the twist of black-eating tobacco in his shirt pocket. "Chew that up, a big hunk of it." Harry stuffed the end in his mouth, bit off a great mouthful, and chewed desperately. Some of the juice ran down his throat. He choked, gagged, felt his bowels heave in nauseated protest, but he chewed on. "Come here!" Harry knelt, helped his father fit a stone into a strip of cloth and press it against the spot where his thumb had been. A burst of blood shot from the wound, was choked down again.
"Tie that around his leg," Mason said. "Tight as you can tie it."
His cheeks bulged with the evil wad Harry tied, pulling until Elmer snapped at him. His father, kneeling on the ripped shirt, was tearing off another strip with his good hand.
"All right, let's see that tobacco."
Harry spat it into the outstretched palm, watched it smeared on the wound, rubbed in with dirty fingers. Elmer winced, his eyebrows drew down, his lips pulled away from his teeth.
"Gosh, I'm sorry, Elmer," Harry said. "I must have reached out too far."
"Tie that,"
his father said harshly. The boy tied the strip of sweaty shirt over the daubed wound. For a moment he remained squatting beside his brother, contrite and sympathetic, and in that moment his father's anger, restrained till now by the immediacies of first aid, blew out of him like an explosion.
"God damn you!" he howled.
The boy saw the blow coming but couldn't duck. The back of his father's hand hit him across the mouth, bowled him over on his back. He arose slowly, watchfully, his sullen face sallow, his eyes burning with hatred.
"I didn't go to do it," he said.
The hand hauled back again, and Harry backed away slowly.
"Give me your lip!"
the old man shouted. "God damn it, ain't I got enough worries without you cutting Elmer all to hell and bringing on doctor bills? Who's going to cut this hay now?" Harry had backed away to a safe distance.
"Well, I'm not, by God," he blazed. "That's the last time you ever hit me!"
He turned and ran across the mown edge of the meadow, climbed the fence, went into town and hunted up the doctor and directed him to the place where Elmer lay, and started west out of town. He never came back. In Davenport, 3 days later, he found his brother Dave.
"You did just right," Dave said. "The hell with the old bastard."
"Only thing I feel mean about is running out on L," Harry said. "That was a bad cut." Dave, while driving his dray, had learned to talk tough and smoke stogies, and he wore leather wrist protectors studded with brass nails.
"Hell," he said, "what's a cut on the leg? He'll be all right. Anyway, you can write him a letter."
So Harry wrote a letter, and in a week got a scrawl back from Elmer saying that the leg was healing and itched like hell, and as soon as it was well, he was going to pull out, too. He was getting sick of hearing the old man moan about his hay. Maybe he'd come to Davenport himself. He'd see how things looked.
"This town ain't what it used to be when the arsenal was booming," Dave said to Harry later. "But there's a lot of building going on. Why don't you learn a trade? That's where the wages is. Learn a trade and you're set. I haul for 2-3 lumber yards. Maybe I can get you on with some carpenter. Want to be a carpenter?"
"I don't care," Harry said. "That's all right." A week later, he was apprenticed to a carpenter, working for board and room and clothes. He stayed at it 2 years, and when he quit, he was good. Even his crabbed old boss admitted it. He had never seen a kid pick up a trade any faster. He had a knack with tools. They cut straight for him, and he didn't cripple himself or them by their misuse. There was also something stubborn and persistent in him under the veneer of toughness he borrowed from Dave. He double-checked measurements, calculated angles 2 or 3 times, drew out a job till he knew what was what. Experienced carpenters seemed to go out of their way to teach him the tricks, and he was earning $2 a day when he was 16. In the evenings he hung around the fringes of Dave's crowd, learning to drink beer, sitting in now and then on a cheap poker game. From those men, teamsters and roustabouts and leftovers from the almost vanished river traffic, he heard stories that put an itch in his feet. They knew Iowa and Illinois and Wisconsin, Chai and Milwaukee. One or two of them had rafted timber all the way down the Wisconsin from Wausau and down the Mississippi from Prairie du Chien to St. Louis. The life they had lived and the places they had seen and spoke of had space in them. So when the master carpenter on a big mansion job snarled at Harry for taking time off to smoke a stogie, he picked up his coat, went home to the room, shook hands with Dave, stuffed into his pocket the few dollars he had saved, and caught a ride on a shanty boat down the river. For 6 months he was on the bum, sleeping in jungles and knowledge boxes, picking up scraps of useful knowledge from hobos and transient laborers moving with the crops. He visited Chicago, and the sight of that city roaring into incredible size and impressiveness on the shore of Lake Michigan left his mind dazed with grandiose visions. Here was really the big town. Here were the gangs of men creating a city out of a windswept slough. Here were freight engines, passenger engines, lake boats, nosing in smoking and triumphant from every direction. Here was money by the millions, a future as big as the sky. But 2 weeks in the big town convinced him that the days when you started with nothing and got to the top were gone as far as Chicago was concerned. All the big money was already well grabbed, and when, nosing around the freight yards, he almost got picked up by a cinder dick, he did the most direct and logical thing. He ducked between two moving trains and swung aboard the outside one. His wanderings took him out through the canal to the Mississippi and down the river to Natchez on a coal barge. Then he worked north again, picking up a few weeks' work here and there on building jobs, getting offers of steady work but turning them down to hit the road again. By the end of 6 months he had a bellyful for the time being, an ingrained and educated contempt for the law and law-abiding people, a handiness at making himself liked by hard-boiled and suspicious men, and an ambition to get somewhere where the cream hadn't been skimmed off, get in on the ground floor somewhere and make his pile. And he had the nickname of Bo. He took the first job that offered, driving spikes in the new spur of the Illinois Central, working westward through Illinois and Iowa. The heavy labor developed him into a man, sheathed his chest and shoulders with muscle, left him hard as a hound. But it brought him again into conflict with authority, with the voice of the boss. The Irish foremen on the line were drivers, loud-mouthed and quick with their fists, and Bo was anything but docile. He talked back, sneered at the section boss, made no effort to keep his voice down when he beefed. That came to a climax on the graded roadbed just at the end of the steel. The crew was bending rails for a gentle curve, locking them in the heavy vices and heaving against them with a surge of muscle. It was hot, back-breaking work in a sun over 100 degrees. Stripped to the waist, the men launched themselves against the springy steel, relaxed, strained again. McCarthy, the foreman, stood at the end, cocking his eye, estimating the curve. He had a hangover, and apparently his cigar was nasty in his mouth because he threw it away. "Come on!" he roared suddenly. "Get some beef into it! You ain't bending a willow switch!" Bo wiped the sweat out of his eyes with his forearm. "I can think of a place I'd like to bend a willow switch," he said. He heaved with the rest rocking against the rail. McCarthy stepped 3 paces closer, dropping his head between his shoulders. "Where would that be, squarehead?" Bo heaved, grunting. "Right across your ash, anti-Irish," he said pleasantly. As if at an order, the men were back from the rail and dropping into a half-circle. Bo and the foreman faced each other on the banked gravel, their feet shuffling lightly, their eyes sparring, their hands up. The foreman lashed out, caught Bo beside the head, took a stiff right cross to the face in return. Like stiff-legged dogs, they circled. The foreman dropped his head and rushed, swinging. For a full minute they stood and slugged it out, neither giving an inch. Then McCarthy stumbled and fell on hands and knees, his mouth hanging and his eyes amazed. The watching men howled as Bo, fighting as he had learned to fight on the road, gave him the boots. McCarthy covered up with his arms and started to roll away, and Bo, tiptoeing like a dancer, followed to crash a kick into the foreman's ribs that shocked him shudderingly still. There was not a sound as he walked away. The men parted and let him by, and wiping his bloody nose as he went, he walked over to the bunkhouse, his head still singing with the power of McCarthy's fists, his ears swelling, but his blood pounding with a triumph so high and savage that he wanted to yell. The picture of McCarthy lying back there with his ribs caved in was raw alcohol to his soul. He was drunk on it. The toughest Irishman on the crew was back there cold as a clam. The next day he was on his way to Wisconsin, bound for a logging camp where another section hand had worked the winter before. The food, he said, was good, the work hard but agreeable, the wages fair. They would just about be getting crews ready for the winter's cutting. 2 winters in Wisconsin gave him many skills. Either with rifle or shotgun, he was the best shot in camp, so that frequently he got laid off the saw to go hunting for the cook. Those days of prowling the timber with a gun only deepened the wild streak in him, as the work on the crosscut deepened his chest. He took to skis and snowshoes as if he had known them all his life, and he went out of his way to make friends. He was genial, a good storyteller, a hearty drinker and a ribald companion in the towns where the rafts and the Wanagon tied up and the men swarmed ashore for a bender. On winter evenings, when there was nothing doing in the bunkhouse, steaming with the thick smell of drying socks and scorched leather and mutton tallow, he often lay on his bunk reading the one book he had found, a volume of Burns, and before the first winter was up, he had added the whole volume to his fantastic collection of memorized McGuffey. He learned Paul Bunyan yarns, or invented them himself, and when half-tight would sometimes take off on an extemporaneous ballad or poem that lasted half an hour. And he played poker for higher stakes. Those 2 summers, when the camps were shut down, he worked on a farm out of Portage, simply because he liked being outside better than he would have liked a carpenter's job in town. The Portage baseball team discovered him, and in the end of his 2nd summer he leaped into local notoriety by getting a bid from the Terre Haute team in the 3i League. That winter he did not go back to the woods, for reasons which he kept to himself, and when he stood in the yard late in April ready to leave for Terre Haute, the 16-year-old daughter of the house burst into sudden, tempestuous tears and fled to the barn. "For gosh sakes," her father said, "what's the matter with her?" Beau did not enlighten him. He liked playing ball in Terre Haute. It was a wandering life, full of action, and the adulation of fans put a cocky swagger in his walk. His name in the papers pleased him. The fellowship of the gang he played with was good, masculine fellowship, with many afternoons in the ice house cooling off on beer after a game, and many evenings of quiet, intent poker. He lost money, but he learned much. If it had not been for an accident, he might have stayed on as a professional ball player, might even have moved up into the big time, because his hitting was consistent and powerful, and he was a good man behind the plate in the days when catchers worked with a thin, fingerless glove. But late in the season of 1896, he tried to stretch a long hit, got tangled up in a plunging fight for the bag with the opposing third baseman, and came up limping with a badly wrenched knee. That put him on the hospital list for the rest of the season, and he had to get another job. For a while he worked in a glass factory, gave it up because it kept him inside 10 hours a day, went back to his old trade as carpenter, and quit that with pleasure at the beginning of the next season. But the 3rd day of training he wrenched his knee again. In spite of bandages, it felt as if it might cave under him, and it hindered his swing at the plate. Before the middle of the 1st month he had been released from the club, and was selling beer on the road for a Milwaukee brewery. His territory took in all of southern Minnesota, western Iowa, and South Dakota, and sometimes was stretched to include an illicit trip into North Dakota to pick off the blind pig trade. North Dakota was then a focal point for armies of immigrants and land seekers. The trains were full of Norwegian and Russian families burdened down with masses of belongings. The station platforms were piled with bundles and boxes and trunks and farm machinery. The station walls were plastered with posters. Land was for sale everywhere. New lines were pushing across the fertile Red River country and into the western part of the state. Something in the bustle of migration stirred a pulse in Beau Mason. He was not a lazy man. His activities had been various and strenuous since he was 14. But the boredom of carpentry, of towns, of regular hours and wages every Saturday, and orders all the rest of the week, had always made him restless. Here in Dakota there was something else. Here everybody was his own boss. Here was a wide open and unskimmed country where a man could hew his own line and not suffer for his independence. Obstacles raised by nature, cold, heat, drought, the solid resistance of great trees, he could slog through with almost fierce joy. But obstacles raised by institutions and the habits of a civilized community left him prowling and baffled. That was partly why he loved the feel of life in Dakota. Frequently he stopped over for a day or two to go bird shooting, coming home from the wide grasslands and sloughs with a buggy full of prairie chickens, sage hens, grouse, ducks. Those days he remembered, and he remembered the sniff of something remote and clean and active in the prairie wind, the flat country leaning westward toward the Missouri Plateau, the sight everywhere of new buildings, new plowing, new grain elevators rising along the new tracks on the edges of new towns. Saloon conversations were full of tales of fantastic crops.
60 bushel to the acre, men said. 60 bushel, I seen it. I was at the spout of that threshing machine. My God, that wheat grows tall as Iowa corn.
And from train windows, Beau looked out over fields of flax in flower, acres and acres of blue. And then his brewery job, full of traveling as it was, seemed trivial, picayune, confining. He wanted breath in his lungs and the sight of a flock of prairie chickens rising over his gun sights.
"Things are going on out there," he told his boss on the next home stop. "Every time I go through there, the towns along the line are bigger."
His boss sat, pulling a bushy eyebrow with a thumb and forefinger.
"You want to quit?" he said.
"How did you know?"
"You've got the itch in you," his boss said. "I've seen it before. You can stay on if you want. Glad to have you. I've got no complaints about your work or sales."
Bo said nothing.
"Planning to take up a homestead?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
"Don't,"
his boss said, and hauled himself straighter in his chair.
"You take my advice and stay away from farms. I knew a lot of people went to Dakota and Nebraska in the old days, and the ones that made money weren't the ones that sweated themselves skinny farming. The ones that made money was the storekeepers and bankers and saloon keepers. I don't suppose you know anything about banking?"
"No."
"And you wouldn't like running a grocery store?"
"No."
"And it looks like a saloon,"
the old man said and grinned.
"And saloons are banned in Dakota."
"Not if you believe my sales reports," Beau said. They laughed. The old man set the ends of his fingers together and brooded.
"Looky here, son," he said. "I'll make you a proposition. You go out to some new town and set yourself up a place, and I'll help you out. You can draw on me for fixtures and beer and pay me off when you get going. I think you're the kind of guy might make a go of it."
"Thanks," Beau said and rose. "I'll let you know. I want to go look around a little more first." 2 months later, he wrote from Hardanger, saying that he had a good thing in a new town, no local police or anything to bother. He had bought half a building, was putting in bowling alleys himself, had 3 pool tables coming. He'd like a 30-foot bar, mirrors to match it, and a shipment of beer, bottled beer. It was cleaner that way, and it could be kept out of sight. "This town is only 10 years old, he said, "and it's twice as busy now as it was 2-3 years ago. 5 years from now, I'll be buying out the brewery." That was in the summer of 1899. Now it was 1905. In September, the roads were full of wagons, and on mornings when she worked around the house with doors and windows open, Elsa could hear the shunt and crash of boxcars being backed under the spouts of the elevators. When the jolting and puffing stopped, she could, by listening intently, hear the swishing rush as the dipped spout let go its river of wheat into the cars. Harvest excited her, as it had always excited her at home, and one afternoon, on an impulse, she left the house and went down. There were dribbles of golden wheat below the spout, and at the bottom of the elevator wall a shining gold cone. She scooped her hand full and stood back watching, chewing and crunching the wheat kernels till they were sweet, rubbery gum in her mouth. The last car was just being pulled away. Inside the elevator she heard the grunting of a separator engine and the occasional thud of a sack being thumped on the floor. She peeked in. A man she did not know, probably Bill Consett's hired man, was separating seed flax, and Judd Chain, immaculate, dandified, wearing coat and vest even in the fall heat, leaned one shoulder negligently against the wall. He had his hat off, and a streak of sun through the elevator roof glinted on his blonde hair.
"Hello," Elsa said. "I didn't expect to see you in an elevator."
"Come down a good deal," Judd said. "Beau and I are turning grain speculators, buying flax this fall."
"Well," she said,
and could think of nothing else to say to him.
"I'm daffy about flax anyway," Judd said. "Something about it makes me feel good. It's so slick and silky to feel."
He ran his hand into the mouth of a sack and wriggled his fingers.
"We never grew it at home," Elsa said.
"Feel."
She pushed her hand into the brown, flaky seeds. They slipped smoothly up her wrist, cool and dry, millions of polished purple-brown miniature guitar picks. She moved her hand, and the flax swirled like heavy, smooth water against her skin.
"That's nice," she said.
"It's something to see in flower, too," Judd said. "Acres of bluebells."
Her quick look acknowledged something sensitive, almost feminine, in the expression of his face as he caressed the flax with his fingers.
"It's like everything else that's lovely," Judd said. "Dangerous. Boy was drowned in a flax bin here a year ago. Fell in, and it sucked him down before anybody could get to him. We had to empty the whole bin to get him."
He rubbed his wrist with a flat, white hand.
"Nice boy, too," he said. "That's the kind things always happen to. A mean, tough kid now, he'd never know enough to appreciate the feel of flax, and he'd never get caught in it."
"I guess so," Elsa said.
She let her fingers move in the satiny, treacherous seeds.
"Seen Beau lately?" Judd said.
"Not for 3 or 4 days."
"I thought he spent all his time on your front porch."
"Oh, go along," she said. Judd lifted an amused eyebrow. His mouth puckered into an expression almost arch.
"Don't make out that you don't know the conquest you've made," he said.
She blushed. "Oh, fiddlesticks!" "Laugh," Judd said. "You've got poor old Beau roped and hog-tied. You know what he's been like for the last 3 weeks? When the kid that sets them up in the alleys gets his pins up, he has to jump out of there and beat it over to rack the pool balls and then fly up to serve somebody a drink and then hike back to the alleys to set them up again. You know why? Because Beau is standing all that time out by the door watching to see if you won't be coming down the sidewalk." Elsa's face was hot.
"Oh, yes," she said sarcastically. "He's just been a regular pressed romp."
"What's a pressed romper?"
"Preacher's tail. Somebody that's always tagging along, like Beau."
"You don't mind, do you?"
"Oh, no," she said. "I always feel sorry for strays. I pat him on the head once in a while."
His laugh was deep, moist, cavernous, like something alive down a cistern, a laugh that matched oddly with his polished and almost effeminate manners.
"Has Beau asked you anything lately?"
he said. She was startled.
"No. What?"
"I guess he's been pretty busy," Judd said. "I know he's got it on his mind."
"Now you've got me curious."
"Oh, well," Judd said. "I don't know why I shouldn't ask you. He'd get all tangled up in his tongue. How'd you like to go to Devil's Lake next Saturday?"
"Fine," she said. "What for?"
"State trap shoot. Beau's entered in the singles. Would be in doubles, too, but he can't stay away that long. We thought you and Eva might come along for the day. The fair's on, and there's a carnival in town. Big excitement."
"That sounds like fun," she said.
"What if Beau forgets to ask me now?"
"That," Judd said, "is the last thing he'd forget. He might forget his shotgun, maybe, but not you." Chapter 5 She saw him from the parlor window come up the walk with his derby already in his hand,
and because they had a 20-mile drive to make, and the shooting began at 10, she hurried to meet him at the door. He took the lunchbox from her hand and held her elbow while she gathered her skirts for the step up to the axle of the buggy.
"Here we go," he said, "if these old plugs could make it."
Settling herself, she said in surprise, "Why, that's a beautiful team."
"Best old Handley had," Beau said. "If they ever caught up with the times in this burg, they'd have horseless carriages for rent."
He flicked the lines, and the horses snapped into their collars. Their trotting feet beat light and swift on the dust. Elsa knew they could make that 20 miles in 2 hours easily, but it was like Beau to disparage anything he was proud of. Either he or Handley had worked over those horses. Their gray hides shone, their manes were roached, their forelocks tied, their tails curried smooth and glossy. She was glad they weren't docked. A docked horse was a pitiful thing when the flies were bad. Judd was waiting in front of the hotel. Beau didn't slow down. Judd's great flat hand hooked on the rail, his legs swung up, and he slid into the rear seat on the fly. The smell of bay rum came with him.
"Must be in a hurry," he said.
He breathed on the ruby ring on his left hand, rubbed it on his sleeve.
"Pony Express doesn't stop for anything," Beau said.
But they stopped for Eva. In front of her house, Beau whistled and Judd whistled, but nothing happened.
"Still snoring," Beau said. "Go on up and break the door down, Judd."
Judd climbed out.
"Not Eva's door," he said. "I prize my health."
He went up and rapped, bending to listen for movement inside.
"Make some noise, for God's sake," Beau said.
He lifted his voice in a bellow that shocked down the quiet, weed-grown street.
"Hey, Eva!"
The echo bounced off Sprague's barn. Judd knocked again.
"Must be asleep," he said. "That's just what I think," Beau said. "Eva! Hey, Eva! Wake up!"
An upstairs window opened and Eva stuck her head out. Her left hand held a flowered kimono close to her chest.
"Shut up, you big loon," she said. "You'll wake Ma."
The window slammed. They waited 5 minutes, 10. Judd wandered across the porch, cut off a twig from a shrub with his knife, and began peeling it. In the buggy, Beau looked at Elsa, then at his watch.
15 minutes, he said,
and muttered indistinguishable things under his breath.
Maybe she misunderstood the time.
Maybe my hip pocket is a gold mine. She just likes to keep people waiting.
At 6:30, Eva came out in a white pleated shirtwaist and a dark sport skirt that just cleared the ground. Her mouth was very red, and she walked briskly, as if unaware that she had delayed anyone. Judd helped her in, waited while she got over her despairing little laughs and helpless attempts to get her skirts arranged. Beau sucked a back tooth and looked bored, but Elsa reached back and gave Eva a hand.
Men ought to consider that a girl with her waist squeezed at least 4 inches too small couldn't move very freely.
Still, she supposed Eva could have left the corset a little looser.
"Get all prettied up," Beau said.
"I didn't even stop to eat," Eva said, "just on account of you and your noise."
"What were you doing then? You had time for a 10-course meal."
"You needn't act so nasty," Eva said. "I didn't keep you waiting long."
Beau clucked to the team, lifted his derby and ran a hand over his hair, tipped the derby on again at a cocky angle.
"No trouble at all. Do the horses good to have that hour rest."
"Oh, an hour."
"Cut it out," Judd said genially. "We're moving, aren't we?" He moved Beau's shotgun case from under Eva's feet and folded the buffalo robe on the floor so that her feet wouldn't dangle. Eva was always complaining that all seats were made too high for short people. As they drove along the road, the mist was rising from a slough on the left, and a half-dozen ducks turned and swam away into the tules as if pulled on wires.
"Getting close to bird season,"
Beau said, and watched them with a nostalgic eye. The grays lengthened out in a mile-eating trot along the flats. Flickertails jerked and ran and sat up with absurd little hands hanging on their chests.
The light cloud of dust behind them hung a long time in the still air, so that turning at section corners they could see it for a quarter of a mile behind. They sang, the grays went crisply, perfectly matched, heads up and tails arching a little. The mists melted from above the sloughs and the sun burned warmer. They were pulling into the carnival grounds at Devil's Lake at 9:30. Judd lifted Eva down, straightened his vest. "I don't suppose there'll be anything doing till later," he said, and looked at Bo.
"I wouldn't think so," Bo said. "Not till afternoon, anyway."
"I thought you started shooting at 10," Eva said.
Bo wagged his jaw at her.
"What, little Eva remembering the time something starts?"
"How about a stroll through the carnival?" Judd said. Eva looked around her at the long grass.
"It looks wet," she said.
Judd kicked into it, inspected his toe. There were tiny drops of water across the waxed yellow shoe. Under the trees there was still a dewy early morning smell.
"I'll carry you," he said.
"Over in the grounds it's dry."
Eva giggled. "I don't trust you. You're so lackadaisical you'd probably drop me in a puddle."
"You've got us mixed up," Bo said gravely. "That's what I'd do if I was carrying you."
Eva stiffened, but his face was bland.
"Come on, then,"
she said, and stuck her hand in Judd's high elbow. Absurdly short and imposingly tall, they stepped through the grass toward the packed carnival street and the tents set in a long semicircle around the fringe of cottonwoods. Elsa, watching them, heard the early shouts of barkers, the sodden thump of a maul on a stake. She saw the gaudy flashes of color from Cupid dolls and pennants and prizes in a concession tent open to the sun. A merry-go-round squawked for a minute into a fast two-step, and then stopped, and there were six shots, sharp and steady, from an unseen shooting gallery. Along the road from town people were beginning to come on foot and in buggies.
"You shouldn't tease her like that," Elsa said.
"Why not?"
"She might think you meant it."
"I do."
"That's all the more reason for not saying things like that,"
Bo grunted.
"She gives me a pain. Just because Judd gives her a little whirl, she thinks she's got a lifetime lease on him."
"Judd doesn't seem to mind."
"He never minds anything. If you went up and kicked him, he'd turn around and beg your pardon for having his back turned on you."
"Oh, well," Elsa said. "What do you have to do now?"
"Just have to register and get a number. There's a half hour yet."
"Let's go get it done," she said. "Judd says you're going to win a prize."
"I guess not. Too many good shooters here."
"You're a good shooter, too,"
he grinned. "Got confidence in me, hey?"
"Of course," she said.
With the shotgun case under one arm, he steered her toward the screened street of carnival tents. Though she was tall herself, she felt his size beside her, and it pleased her to be walking with him. It wasn't just his size, either. It was the width of his chest, the smooth nut-brown of his skin, the way he walked as if everything in him moved on ball bearings. She hummed, almost skipping, and laughed when he looked at her. At the white tent marked Shooting Headquarters, under a limp American flag, she waited while he registered. He came back with a big paper 13 pinned on his back.
"Slipped me the unlucky number," he said.
One eyebrow was raised in an expression of querulous protest.
"Why, are you superstitious?"
"No, but I'd just as soon have another number."
"Friday the 13th is my lucky day," she said. "I'll loan you my luck."
His shoulder bumped hers as he swung to look around at the white and brown and yellow tents, the sheds housing fair exhibits, the banners of linen paper, the pennants, the flags. The barkers were opening up all down the street. The calliope had started again. The little painted horses of the merry-go-round were rising and falling through the yellowing leaves of the cottonwoods. At the far end of the grounds a great wheel began to turn, curving up against the cloudless sky, and a girl's squeal cut through the jumble of crowd sound.
"What in heaven's name is that?" Elsa said.
"Ferris wheel. Haven't you ever been on one?"
"I never saw one before."
"Take you for a ride when the shooting's over," he said.
The corners of his eyes crinkled with a smile of pure delight.
"God," he said, "I like the smell of a place like this, even.
When I was a kid, I was always going to run away and join a circus. Minute I get near one, I start snorting and pawing the ground. They were in the midst of a pushing crowd. For a moment, their eyes met, and they stood foolishly smiling, oblivious to the push of shoulders and the jabber of voices and the danger of having an eye put out by a parasol rib. Then he grabbed her arm and pulled her along behind him.
"Come on. I don't think I can miss today."
"You had better not," Elsa said. "I'll take a sandwich out of your lunch for everyone you miss."
"Give me a kiss for everyone I hit?"
"Ninny on your tintype," she said, and pulled her arm away. Ahead of them, dropping toward the low shore of the lake, was a dike of earth, and behind it, a little distance, a crowd was lining up, sitting on newspapers, robes, bare ground. They were men mostly, but there was a sprinkling of women, bright against the yellowing trees and the gray earth. Below them, on the level ground behind the five dugout traps, three men sat at a table. Men with shotguns in their hands and numbers on their backs clustered around the shooting ground. A clay pigeon hissed in an experimental arc over the water and fell.
"I mean it," Beau said, and they were stopped again. A faint, teasing smile hung on his mouth. "I won't even shoot unless you promise."
"You might as well not unpack your gun, then," she said, but his look made her feel dizzy and absurd and hot, and as if she were going to fly all to pieces. She had come to the point of meeting his eyes and trying to stare him down, both of them laughing, when the man with the megaphone began to announce the opening of the singles traps for the championship of North Dakota.
"Promise," Beau said. "Don't be a piker. I can't shoot for any such stakes as the championship of Dakota."
Elsa got hold of the disintegrating feeling and fingered the enameled brooch at her throat. She was delighted and a little terrified. "We'll see," she said. They found Judd and Eva sitting among the spectators behind the second trap. Eva had a Cupid doll in her lap. "Won it on a toy horse race," she said. "That's what comes of having a beau that knows the ponies. My horse was never behind." She reached out and pinched Judd's ankle, and he moved it calmly out of reach. One of the men at the table read off the names of the first shooters who lined up behind the traps. Beau leaned over and began explaining to Elsa. They shot in groups of 25 rounds. The first was the easiest. Known traps and known angles, the shooter knowing the source and direction of each bird. There would be a clump of possibles on this one. Then came 25 shots at known traps but unknown angles. The bird might come straight out or to either side. That was tougher. The third and fourth rounds, the shooters went out singly. In the third round, they shot reversing, standing at number one trap and getting a crossing bird from number five, then standing at number two and getting a bird out of number four, and so on. The last 25 rounds was expert. You didn't know which trap the bird would come from or in what direction. Her eyes were on him almost in horror, but she was laughing still. "You shoot 100 times, she said, "and you're an extra good shot, and you have the nerve."
100 isn't so many."
She noticed for the first time what it was that made his face so changeful and interesting. His eyebrows turned up rather than down at their outside ends, like a devil. He was a devil. 100 times.
"I might miss as many as 6, he said slyly. "That'd only be 94.
"Keep the gun in the case," she said, and waved him away. He laughed and leaned back. A white saucer whizzed out of the first trap. The first shooter caught it with his barrels, fired. The saucer shivered to fragments, its thin splashings as the pieces hit the water, clearly audible even over the echo of the shot, rolling back from the shore.
"Good bird," said an official, clearly.
The scorer at the table echoed him. "Good bird." The second shooter stood ready.
"Pull,"
he said. Beau kept a score with a stick on the bare ground. If anyone missed more than 2, he erased the whole score.
"Don't need to worry about them. Guy that wins this has to shoot a possible on the first 2 rounds.
A man with a sheet of paper in his hand went around reading off the next names.
"Simmons, 1. Carter, 2. Shale, 3. Galbranson, 4. Galbraith, 5.
Ready for the next squad. Simmons, Carter, Shale, Gulbranson, Galbraith.
They run these off pretty smooth, Beau said. He opened the case and took out the stock and then the barrels, fitted the gun together, broke it, and snapped it together again, his automatic hand going down to scratch in the tallies. He wiped off the stock, ran the ramrod through the shining barrels. His hands moved on the blue steel almost tenderly. Then he laid the gun across his feet and watched again.
"You'll be up pretty soon," Elsa said.
He nodded, and she saw the tightening that had come over the muscles in his jaw and neck, the intense seriousness around his eyes. He seemed almost to have forgotten who she was, that she was even there. Of the first two squads, only two men had possibles, Carter and Olson. Beau watched Olson with a steady, almost basilisk look. "There's the guy to beat," he said. "He doesn't let down between shots at all. He's a shooter, that guy." The squad hustler came around reading names, Beau's among them. When he stood up with the gun across his arm, Elsa felt excited and nervous, weak with the desire to have him win.
"Hit everyone," she said, and had to hold her hands back to keep from reaching out to touch him.
It grinned at her absently. "Can't miss," he said. "See you after a while."
$5, you make a possible, Judd said.
Beau shook his head. "You jinx me." He walked down to the table and joined the squad, filling their pockets with shells. The last roar of Number 5's gun rolled along the shore, and Number 5 walked back into the crowd. Then Beau was standing behind Number 3 trap, hatless, his gun over his arm.
"Pull,"
the first man said. The clay bird arced, the gun came up, the roar of the shot mushroomed in the still air. Then Number 2, then Beau. Each time Beau shot, Elsa scratched a tally on the ground. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. It took a long time, but every good bird was a little triumph. Glancing up from her tense concentration, she saw Judd watching her. He lifted his eyebrows, and she made a face. The 13th bird was coming. 13. She stiffened herself, trying to loan him her luck.
"Pull,"
he said. The saucer shot out, but wobbly, weak, short. Beau raised the gun, hesitated, let the bird fall.
"No bird," the referee said. "No bird," said the scorer.
Beau fished up a handkerchief swiftly and wiped his face. The handkerchief trailed whitely out of his side pocket as he half raised the gun again.
"Pull,"
he said. The bird whirred up. He caught it with the barrels quickly, too quickly, and missed it cleanly. Elsa sat back with a noisily released breath.
"Tough luck," Judd said, but Eva turned with an incredulous smile.
"What do you know?" she said. "I never knew Beau was superstitious."
"He isn't."
"Don't tell me," Eva said. "He was nervous on that 13th one."
"He got a bad bird," Judd said. "Breaks of the game."
Beau was slow coming back. When he sat down beside them, there was a clamp on his jaw and a shine of hard anger in his eyes.
"You did fine," Elsa said.
His laugh was hard and choppy, a disgusted sound. "I did fine, all right. Let myself get jinxed on that 13 ball."
"But only 2 hit them all," she said, "and only 3 others got all but 1. You're tied for second."
"That isn't good enough," he said. "This Olsen bird doesn't miss enough so you can afford to fool around."
He sounded almost as if he were scolding her for saying he had done well. His voice was so snappish that she kept quiet. It was afternoon when he finished his second round. Going down still sore at the way things had broken in the first, he had missed the very first bird. And then in a cold fury that Elsa could see in his very shoulders and the set of his neck, had run out the remaining 24 as if each had been a personal enemy. Carter had dropped 1, Olson none, and the rest of the field had dropped back so that Beau was 3rd with 48 against Carter's 49 and Olson's possible. His string of 24 restored his temper, and when Elsa took 2 sandwiches out of his lunch, he groaned.
"I'll be so weak I can't pull the trigger," he said.
"I guess the 4 you've had will keep you from starving. Besides, you lost them fair and square."
I won 48 of something else, though.
I never promised.
What?
Eva said.
What did she promise?
I didn't promise anything.
Now you're welching, Bo said.
I'm not either welching. I never promised. Besides, you're not through yet.
When I'm through, you'll welch again.
What I want to know, Eva said, is what did she promise?
None of your business, Bo said bluntly, watching Elsa.
You hit the next 50, and I really will promise, she said. And when I promise anything, I do it.
The full upper lids of Bo's eyes made his face look slitted like a mask, but he was smiling a fixed and concentrated smile.
Okay, he said. I'll remember.
Judd hitched himself over until he had his back against a tree. He reached down and unlaced his yellow shoes. What I hate about being up in the daytime, he said, is that you have to wear shoes, and shoes hurt my feet something terrible. He pulled one off and sighed, reached for the other. Eva squealed affectedly.
Right at the table, she said. Put them on again, for heaven's sake.
Bo's heavy-lidded eyes changed expression, were veiled with scorn. I suppose you've never seen Judd's feet.
Where would I have seen his feet?
He shrugged. Since he never wears anything but slippers, hardly, you might have seen them.
Well, I don't go where Judd works, she said.
Judd sat looking down the immense length of his legs at his stockinged toes. He wriggled them experimentally. You talk as if my feet were an everyday attraction, he said. Not everybody has 13 toes. I could make a good living in a sideshow with my feet.
13 toes, Elsa said. Has he?
I never bothered to count 'em, Bo said. They look like a couple of cartridge belts. Elegantly relaxed, his face bland and amused, looking more than ever like an actor, Judd continued to wriggle his feet. Elsa watched him, this remote and fastidious impostor who could quite easily, without showing it in the least, change the subject, get Bo and Eva away from their outspoken dislike, make everything smooth and casual again.
"Want to see?" Judd said.
"You can't scare me," Elsa said.
He took off one sock and showed 7 toes. The other foot, he said, had only 6, though there was a little nubbin that, with applications of hair restorer or something, might be made to grow. Eva covered her eyes and squealed at him to cover up his awful old feet. He looked like a centipede. From back on the grounds, over the faint musical wheezing of the calliope, came the dull boom of a shotgun. Bo looked at his watch. I've got to be getting back, he said. He helped Elsa stow the scattered remains of the lunch in the buggy. Judd put his shoes back on with unhurried deliberation, rose and stretched. Eva consulted her face in a little pocket mirror. A man, small, dark, with a red birthmark smearing one side of his face, came through the trees. He passed clusters of picnicking people, looking at them sharply as if in search of someone. Then he saw Judd and came directly over. Eva put the mirror away and straightened her dress, but the man threw only one brief glance at the others before he led Judd out of earshot. Judd nodded, lifted his head as if musing, nodded again. They laughed together, lighting cigarettes, and stood looking back through the grounds past the colored, moving specks of the merry-go-round horses. The little man bent his arm, stuck the hand out at an angle, wriggled it, his bony white hand darting like a snake's head. Judd nodded, and the little man went away.
"Who was that?" Eva said.
"Fellow I used to know in Fargo," Judd said. "Joe Theodoratus.
What is he, an Indian or something?"
"Greek, I guess." He bent over to brush his trousers, and as he bent, Elsa saw a look pass between him and Bo.
"What did he want?"
"Got a deal on," Judd said. "Wants to talk to me a little while. You wouldn't mind going to watch Bo shoot, would you, Bertie?"
Eva's brows gathered. "You mean you want to run out and leave me?"
"I have to attend to this," Judd said. "Bo and Elsa will take care of you."
"So I have to stick in the mud while you go off. How long will you be?"
"We're the mud," Bo said and winked at Elsa. "I'll be an hour or so," Judd said. His face did not lose its bland and mannerly smile, and his voice did not lift, but Elsa thought she caught something passing between them that she interpreted as a command. Eva turned away petulantly and gave in.
"You'll have more fun watching Bo shoot anyway," Judd said. "That's what we came up here for, to watch Bo shoot."
He straightened his patterned vest and settled the derby on his neat head. "Well, if you'll excuse me for a little while..."